When I was a child, I thought of my father as connected to the larger world, the glittering city. Every day, my tall, slim father, dressed in a dark suit and tie, combed his brown hair with a pronounced part to the side, groomed his thin Don Amici mustache and headed to the city, a Rudolph Valentino look-alike, very Italian. My father knew the city, and it was a point of pride for him. The King of New York, my husband called him recently. My father was born in Manhattan on the Lower East Side, and the New York of his youth was his private heartland. He boasted about having been rough in school and being kicked out in the eighth grade after a fight in which his nose was broken into an exaggerated Roman beak. He would tell again and again how he was expelled. Bored with the story, my mother would murmur with vague disapproval, "Oh yeah, a tough guy."
Critic Mariana DeMarco Targovnik. She's here to talk about her new book, Crossing Ocean Parkway, Readings by an Italian-American Daughter, an account of ethnicity, social mobility, and the American dream. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. From the beginnings of the Republic, Americans have engaged in debates about national identity, cultural diversity, political norms, and the meaning of individual roots. In the 1990s, as perhaps never before, these discussions have focused on questions about race, ethnicity, and gender. Those subjects are central to a new book whose author speaks from the standpoint of an Italian-American daughter. The book is Crossing Ocean Parkway. The author is Mariana DeMarco Targovnik of Duke University. Focusing on social and individual mobility through writing that's informal and personal, Crossing Ocean Parkway examines ethnicity, changing women's roles, and the place of intellectuals in contemporary American society. When she visited the National Humanities Center just before the holidays last year, Mariana DeMarco Targovnik said that one of the starting points for her book was the racially motivated murder of a young man named Yusef Hawkins in the New York City neighborhood of Bensonhurst, where she grew up. I asked Mariana DeMarco Targovnik to read from Crossing Ocean Parkway.
Over the next few days, the TV news is even more disturbing. Rows of screaming Italians lining the streets, most of them looking like my relatives. The young men wear undershirts and crosses dangle from their necks as they hurl curses. I focus especially on one woman who resembles almost completely my mother. Stocky but not fat, mid-70s but well-preserved, full face showing only minimal wrinkles, ample steel-gray hair, rigidly styled in a modified beehive hairdo. She shakes her fist at the camera, protesting the arrest of the Italian-American boys in the neighborhood and the incursion of more blacks into Bensonhurst, protesting the shooting. I look a little nervously at my mother, the parent I most resemble, but she hasn't even noticed the woman and stares impassively at the television.
Mariana DeMarco Targovnik, welcome to the National Humanities Center. What did Ocean Parkway symbolize for you when you were a kid?
Well, Ocean Parkway is something that is meaningful to anyone who grows up in New York. Ocean Parkway is a street that runs down the center of Brooklyn. It's what I think of as the Jerusalem of Brooklyn. It's a place where ethnic groups come together, not always easily and not always happily. When I was growing up, the two groups that were coming together were the Italian Americans from working class neighborhoods on one side, and Jewish Americans from middle class neighborhoods on the other side.
Now this is very explicit. This is a real tangible sort of dividing line.
This is a real tangible sort of dividing
line. We're not talking about literary symbolism.
No. It's twice as wide as any other street that I can think of in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up, it was lined by huge Dutch elms. When the street was renovated, the trees were replaced. And so when I come back to Brooklyn now, it looks to me as though the trees have shrunk.
What was on the two sides of the street here? What did one side represent in contrast to the other?
The two sides were identical, but the street itself was a boundary. And if you went a block on either side of the street, that's where you would notice the difference. Mm-hmm. On the Italian-American side, you would find multifamily houses, four-family houses, some two-family houses, very rarely a single-family house. On the Jewish-American side, you'd find many more single-family houses. a lot of apartment buildings rather than the four-family house, buildings that were more stylish, buildings mm-hmm. that seemed to symbolize a kind of wealth. On the parkway itself, you'd find a lot of single-family houses in a kind of Spanish style that's totally out of place and very unusual in Brooklyn.
Now, what did this street symbolize, to come back to that, that literary kind of terminology, what did it symbolize in terms of the issues that you write about in Crossing Ocean Parkway? We're talking about ethnic loyalty. We're talking about mobility. We're talking, to use a very large term, the American dream. Explain that to me.
Well, if you grow up in New York, a lot of the available symbols of the American dream simply aren't there. The Cartwright brothers on Bonanza.
which you talk about
Which I
watching.
Talk about. Robin Hood right. On television. Sky King, just to give you a somewhat dated reference, with his niece Penny. Those things aren't available in Brooklyn, but Ocean Parkway is. And what Ocean Parkway symbolized is the way you get to Manhattan. If you're driving to Manhattan, which I very rarely did, you nonetheless would drive up Ocean Parkway to get to the bridges that go to Manhattan. So it's entrance into the city. Mm-hmm. The life of culture, the life of the mind. It's also upward mobility, because most of the most expensive housing in Brooklyn, outside of a few neighborhoods like Brooklyn Heights and Manhattan Beach, the most expensive housing is on Ocean Parkway. So if you move to Ocean Parkway, you're likely to be moving someplace else soon. Mm-hmm. So it's a symbol of upward mobility, of crossing into culture. In terms of my own particular background, it was a symbol of switching allegiances, or rather adding allegiances, not just the Italian Americans with whom I grew up, but the Jewish Americans with whom I was friends later on.
Now, at the beginning of our program this week, Mariana, we heard you read a passage about ethnic conflict.
Yes.
And you referred to a woman who looked like your mother.
Yes.
Why is it? I mean, is there any special reason that Ocean Parkway sort of represents a convergence or a place where these clashes would occur in New York City?
Well, this particular, the incident that I'm describing there is in Bensonhurst.
In Bensonhurst.
Probably closer to 18th Avenue, a very different kind of street.
And when I say New York City, most people might think of what, Manhattan?
No, it's Brooklyn.
Yeah,
definitely,
Brooklyn.
Definitely Brooklyn. Ocean Parkway, nonetheless, is a real symbol street. Mm-hmm. Whenever a politician is doing campaigning and wants to reach the Jewish vote, they come to Ocean Parkway.
I see.
If you drive down Ocean Parkway on any given day, you can tell what's happening ethnically in the city. For example, if you go there now as opposed to when I was growing up, you'll notice that there's a strong African-American population, Hispanic population, and Asian population at the part of the street that's closest to Prospect Park. Mm-hmm. But when you get to the part of the street that's closest to the ocean and Coney Island, then you're back to the Jewish-Italian mix with some Asians in the way that I grew up.
Is this book about a kind of hope for racial and ethnic harmony in this country? There again is a very large order. How did you think of it when you got this wonderful mix of peoples and backgrounds and cultures?
I don't think that it's a book about the hope for racial harmony, although I would certainly hope for racial harmony. It seems to me maybe a little sanguine to think that any one person's experiences is going to be able to affect that kind of transformation. It is a book about cultural combining. And the sort of hybrid nature of ethnic identity. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me to call myself Italian-American is only partially true. I'm also somebody who's been through the universities. I'm also someone who's been married for a long time to a Jewish-American. Mm-hmm. So that just this week, for instance, I've celebrated Hanukkah and now I'm getting ready for Christmas. And I do that real smoothly without uh-huh. missing a beat.
Is there a reason, Mariana, that the kind of book that you have written, it's called Crossing Ocean Parkway, would happen now in the mid-90s? We seem to have, maybe not a flood, but we have a number of books that are coming out that have a kind of scholarly or autobiographical ring to them, and that look at issues of ethnicity and gender and multiculturalism. Is that a fair way to talk about what you've done here?
It's not a way. It's not a fair way that I'd like to talk about it. I think I'd like to put it in a
yeah.
somewhat different context. I think it's the confluence of a number of circumstances. Circumstance number one, although this may sound a little distant at first, is the aspiration of people like me who've been literary critics to be more writerly mm-hmm. and to reach a wider audience.
The public intellectual, for
the
lack
public
of
intellectual
a
model,
term.
which was enormously appealing to me all the way through graduate school, but was a role into which I had to develop. It was not something that I could really be trained to do as mm-hmm. a graduate student. So in order to reach a wider audience, you need to write about more common experiences. And one of the things which I think is a pleasant surprise, is that one's own life experiences, if treated in a non-specialized way, if written about in a way that thinks about readers, can reach a wide variety of people.
Are you going to take a lot of heat from colleagues in the profession who think that literary studies ought to be, well, to use your term, distant, or another way to put that would be stodgy and academic, rather than this sort of kind of free-flowing and spirited personal discussion that you get into?
I haven't taken a lot of heat so far. In fact, one of my theories about academic life is that academics have a theory about the way they're supposed to write, and if they would just get rid of the theory, they might find themselves able to reach a lot of people. I know one of the, I began this kind of writing with my last book, Gone Primitive, and one of the questions I was asked repeatedly by people beginning in the profession was, how can I risk doing this kind of writing?
Well, one reason is you got tenure.
That's the simple answer.
Yeah.
But there's another level of answer, which I would then go on to give after saying, I've got tenure and I've got protection. I don't need to pass committees anymore. But the other answer is, how can you afford not to do this kind of writing?
Mm-hmm.
Since there's something about the usual academic writing, which is saying, don't read me. Don't pay attention to me. And it was very important to me as I developed in my career to do a kind of writing that said, read me. You know, pay attention to me, spend some time with me.
Did your experience, in New England? You taught at a small New England school, and you have very mixed feelings about that experience as you recount this in Crossing Ocean Parkway. Was that a lesson to you in terms of, how shall we put it, sort of going public and becoming more breezy and informal? No less intellectually rigorous, perhaps, but again, seeking these wide audiences.
In writing about that material?
Yeah.
Well, the lessons I learned there would have been more, I think, inhibiting of the writing experience. I mean, I think I learned a lot of lessons about bad academic writing
there. About
not,
what not to do.
What not to do. Mm-hmm. There's an image that I think expresses it really well. Academic writing is sometimes like building an armadillo. You line the thing with metal plate. You put it on the floor and let it run for its life as people take shots at it. And it was precisely doing a more vulnerable kind of writing, taking off some of the metal plate, letting some of the vulnerability and personality show through that I was after.
Mariana, the title of your book is Crossing Ocean Parkway. You divide it into two sections. Crossing Ocean Parkway is the title of the first one. The second one is called Readings by an Italian-American Daughter, and you've got some wonderful titles here. Dr. Doolittle and the Acquisitive Life. What is that all about?
Well, that's about trying to get in some experiences that people often don't write about, and the experience that I'm writing about here is the experience of reading to one's children, and the kinds of echoes that sets up in one's experience and in one's mind. With
talk
the
about
reading
personal
you did as a child.
Notes, rather than the academic kind of pursuit.
Well, this is also a book about women's changing roles, and so it's important in this book that I'm a wife and a mother and a daughter and the child of aging parents. I mean, those are all equally important with the fact that I'm an intellectual. And this is about literally the experience of starting to read Dr. Doolittle to my children and discovering racist passages before the new editions came out, and then discovering new joys and surprises in the books as I was reading.
Are we talking about political correctness here? What?
No, I don't think we're talking about political correctness, although the Dr. Doolittle thing was really pitched in terms of political correctness. Dr. Doolittle was a bestseller in this country since the 1920s and went out of print in the late 60s after he was accused of being a racist and a chauvinist. Now, I don't want to use the term political correctness because I think it's much too messy, but nonetheless, the books went out of print. They finally came back into print in 1988 after they had been edited to remove some of these offensive remarks. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing for me was that as the reader of this book to my children, I had naturally edited those remarks out.
So you were ahead of the curve.
I was ahead of the curve because when you're reading a book like that to kids, it's bedtime. They're always meant to be edited, those books, so that you can wind it up in order to get the children to bed properly.
Well, now let me argue with you for a moment, Mariana.
Yeah.
Are those books defensible? The other example that comes to mind is Babar, the little elephant. And,
yes.
There's those books and illustrations have been accused of harboring a lot of racism. Are they defensible at all because one should or could look at them in terms of the time that produced them, rather than, you know, sort of rectifying and modifying them here for readers in the 1990s?
That would be one way to go, but the way that I prefer to go is to think about why parents want to read these books to their children and why children love them so much. Mm-hmm. I think that both of these books, but I'm going to concentrate on The Doolittle, with which I'm more familiar, they're about strong feelings of love for animals, a kind of respect for other species, and a category that I can only describe as goodness of heart.
Uh-huh.
And in a world ruled by goodness of heart, racial difference doesn't matter. So I think that despite the superficial disturbing aspects of the book, there's another level at which they're really terrific.
What about The Godfather? Now here again, you know, we're sort of moving all over the map in this book. Why do you write about The Godfather as an important, what you call a reading by an Italian-American daughter? Why is that important?
Well, The Godfather was the first time I ever wrote about myself and mentioned my ethnicity in writing. I was writing about The Godfather. So for me, it was a book which allowed me to explore my ethnicity in writing for the first time.
The book, not the movie.
The book, not the movie.
Uh-huh.
In teaching the book, I've become aware since that it does pose disturbing problems for African Americans in particular. There are a number of references in it that I simply didn't notice, and it's mm-hmm. good to read it with a different lens.
Not to mention what it does to women.
The views of women are pretty appalling, and that, of course, I was very sensitive to that because mm-hmm. I thought that there was both a kind of exaggeration about it, but also an accuracy.
But nonetheless, you don't hesitate to take this into class or to use it to refer to it in front of your students?
I don't hesitate to bring it into class.
Uh-huh.
The students normally understand, are able to deal with that material, and of course it gets uh-huh. raised in the course of the discussion. I think I would be uncomfortable with it if those kinds of themes were to be papered over or were considered off limits.
What about, Mariana, what you call the feel of a culture? Now here again, we're looking at all these this variety of topics that you treat in Crossing Ocean Parkway. We've talked about the Doolittle books and The Godfather. Let's go to your education. Here we talk about a legendary professor at Columbia, a man named Lionel Trilling. Why is he important as a subject for a reading by an Italian-American daughter?
Well, something I didn't think about until after I had written about Trilling was the fact that he's a Jewish American professor and someone who suffered early in his career for that. And so in a way, he's another one of these transitional figures, another gateway figure into intellectual life.
And you therefore sort of sympathize with him? Or
I wasn't even aware of it when I was a graduate student at Columbia. He looked like a WASP. He talked like a WASP. I assumed he was a WASP. I wasn't yet sufficiently sensitive to ethnic differences to be uh-huh. able to make those kinds of distinctions. I didn't sympathize with him, but I respected him. I think the most important thing about Trilling for me is the way that he established the idea of the critic as public intellectual, as somebody who would write for the culture, as somebody who would think about the culture. And I went to Columbia Graduate School, and his work established a general ambiance,
mm-hmm.
Which has been fulfilled in people like Edward Said and others.
Let's move to another end of the spectrum. On the one hand, you write about Lionel Trilling and professors who go public, become public intellectuals. You've got a section in your book called The Paglia Principle. Now, here we come to the a person who, in the opinion of many today, is a sort of an outrageous academic, Camille Paglia. What about her? Why is she in your book?
Well, she's definitely an outrageous academic. She's in my book because she's an Italian-American critic, because I had a very strong response to her book, and because she's one of these people whose intellectual preoccupations mesh in an uncanny way with mine, but who's coming at almost every topic from a different angle.
Uh-huh.
For instance, her writing about the woman's body is full of a kind of cultural cliché often articulated by men of the woman's body as disgusting. And my book is a book which celebrates female bodies and female sexuality.
Camille Paglia has a lot of good things to say about a figure like Madonna. What's your take on people like Madonna in our pop culture?
I have no especially bad things to say about Madonna. I mean, I think she's an inventive and a creative person.
Uh-huh.
But I also felt that she, like Paglia herself, is somebody who risks overexposure.
Is she a good role model, to come to a pretty stuffy term here, for Italian-American daughters in the 1990s?
I don't think she's a role model for Italian-American daughters at all.
She's just herself.
Huh? She's herself. The only part of her that I think would be a great role model is her financial success.
Fair enough.
And the way that she's gone into business.
Uh-huh.
She doesn't seem like a very likely role model.
Mariana Targovnik, we're talking about your book, Crossing Ocean Parkway. One of the themes that runs through this book is the paradox of what you call individuality and community. You have a tension between mobility on the one hand, in a sort of ethnic or financial sense, and on the other side, a loyalty to your ethnic background. There is a tension between the desire to live the good life, to be acquisitive, and yet to be loyal to your spiritual roots. Now, those are some pretty big orders. Talk to me for a moment about those.
Well, one of the things I realized in writing this book is that you can take the girl out of Bensonhurst, but you can't take the Bensonhurst out of the girl. So part of what I'm wrestling with is the way that your roots, your ethnic roots, whatever they might be, I've had Southerners tell me that it works the same way for them.
Mm-hmm.
Your ethnic roots are very nourishing. They're also very choking. And part of the process of coming of age in our culture or any culture is learning how to cope.
How have you figured out a way to balance that act?
I think that as you get older, I'm moving into middle age now. It's something that happens naturally, or if it doesn't happen, you better do something about
mm-hmm.
it. Part of it, I think, is living as I do now in a culture which is so different from the one that I grew up with, that one begins to treasure some of the things that you took for granted.
For example, your kids, are you happy? Are you upset that they might be talking like Southerners?
I mean, they don't talk like Southerners.
Here you teach over at Duke University. You live in Durham. What about that?
They don't talk like Southerners. They talk like New Yorkers, which is kind of funny.
So it's what they hear at home, huh?
It's what they hear at home. I remember when they were little and were going to daycare with Southern women, they both began to say, milk. And it was the only time I ever corrected
them.
Or
I'm fixing to, or I'll carry you here.
No, they never did that. But I remember saying, milk. Milk. And then I noticed one of my daughters, every time I would do that, she would push her nose up in the air and say, milk, milk. And I got the idea very quickly.
Mariana, again, the title of your book is Crossing Ocean Parkway, Readings by an Italian-American Daughter. Is because of that subtitle, is this a book for women? Is it a woman's book, quote unquote?
I thought it might be. But as it turns out, it's not. The first time I did a public reading of from this book, I read the essay about my father, which is at the end of the book, my father's death from lung cancer. And there was a young man in the audience who had blue hair and nose rings and multiple earrings who came up to me afterwards and said, "Do women like that essay?" And I looked at him and I said, "I was afraid men wouldn't." And he said, "Oh, no. If I ever have a daughter, I hope she writes that way about me."
So you want this book to appeal not only to women. It is not a woman's book.
No, I don't think it's a woman's book. I wouldn't say at all, because I hope it is a woman's book.
Is it a book? Is it a book about feminism? Is it a book that has any kind of an ideological bent to it that a reader should
I really
be aware
don't
of?
Think it is. I think it's a book about ethnicity and upward mobility and moving between cultures and crossing between roles,
uh-huh.
things that almost anybody in our life and time can relate to.
It's also a book about taking a risk as an academic by building your personal life into a book that discusses seriously educational issues, and it will have some after effects here, because, I mean, parents are going to read this book, kids are going to read this book who are going off to college. What about that?
I don't think it's so much a risk as a willingness to let people know that academics have a total personality. And
they're
that,
human
and
they beings
be,
who live lives out of the classroom.
Yeah,
right?
And I can't think of anything but good coming out of that, although I must say when I thought about the fact that my students would have access to all this information, I really had to think twice. It's something I hadn't really thought of. And a lot of the letters I've gotten from colleagues have been along the lines of, "I've gotten to know you so much better."
Is it a confessional book?
No, it's not. It seems to me it's much too controlled a form of writing to be a confessional book, and there's not a bit of autobiographical writing here which is not somewhat linked to a cultural context like the racial murder in Bensonhurst that was its motivation.
Mariana, let me take that as a cue to end our conversation in a way where you began, that is to say, talking about Bensonhurst and this awful episode, the murder of Yusuf Hawkins. In what way did that inspire your book?
It gave me my first occasion, and I would actually say my first imperative to do autobiographical writing in an extended way. I found myself writing about Bensonhurst, all kinds of things about Bensonhurst. It was almost as though I had been waiting for years to say these things, mm-hmm. and had never thought anyone would be interested.
The ethnic sort of became personal for you. Have I got that right?
The ethnic was always personal for me. I think what happened by the dubious virtue of this racial murder was that the personal became something that needed to be a matter of public record.
A legitimate subject.
Something that I felt I had to write about and uh-huh. that I thought that people would be interested in writing about. The essay is structured according to a number of scenes, and they just came right out. It was almost like giving birth to a complete essay, a very unusual experience.
Well, it's a powerful book, Mariana. Let me tell our listeners about you and about it. You are Mariana DeMarco Targovnik. You're a professor of English over at Duke, and your new book is Crossing Ocean Parkway. We should also mention Gone Primitive. That's another of your books. These are what? Both from the University of Chicago?
That's right.
Mariana, thanks for coming by to be on Soundings. I wish you well in your work.
Thank you for having me.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest was Mariana DeMarco Targovnik of Duke University. Her new book is Crossing Ocean Parkway, Readings by an Italian-American Daughter. In a moment, information about where to write for an audio cassette of this program. You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. For an audio tape of this program, send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 761. That's program number 761. The address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. We're interested in your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at uncecs.edu. Next week, the latest from novelist Clyde Edgerton. He'll be here to talk about Red Eye, his new novel about an itinerant undertaker, archaeology and the American West at the turn of the 19th century, polygamy, and a mean little dog named Red Eye. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Crossing Ocean Parkway, readings by an Italian-American daughter, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a discussion with cultural critic Mariana DeMarco Targovnik of Duke University. She'll be here to talk about her account of social mobility, ethnicity, and contemporary American intellectual life as seen from the perspective of an Italian-American daughter. Crossing Ocean Parkway, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.